Chapter here. I am very biased in a leaning that I've come to my understanding with my studying here. So while I will try to, how can I put it, kind of be balanced about it once we get down to it, it is going to definitely be evident the direction that I lean on the particular subject. In fact, I'll probably just come right out and say it once we get down there, but that's once we get into that particular area there. How many verses is it again? What we've got here is 25 verses. Let's go ahead and read all 25 verses, and we'll get the whole chapter read, and then we'll find out what all we're able to do. So beginning at verse number 1, "And it came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for warfare to fight with Israel. And Achish said unto David, Know thou assuredly that thou shalt go out with me to battle, thou and thy men. And David said to Achish, Surely thou shalt know what thy servant can do. And Achish said to David, Therefore will I make thee keeper of mine head forever. And Samuel was dead, and all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, even his own city. And Saul had put away those that had familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. And the Philistines gathered themselves together and came and pitched in Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they pitched in Gilboa. And when Saul saw the host of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart greatly trembled. And when Saul inquired of the Lord answered him not, neither by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by prophets. Then said Saul unto his servants, Seek me a woman that hath a familiar spirit, that I may go to her, and inquire of her. And his servant said to him, Behold, there is a woman that hath a familiar spirit at Endor. And Saul disguised himself, and put on other raiment, and he went, and two men with him. And they came to the woman by night, and he said, I pray thee, divine unto me by the familiar spirit, and bring him up whom I shall name unto thee. And the woman said unto him, Behold, thou knowest that Saul hath done, how he hath cut off those that have familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. Wherefore then layest thou a snare for my life to cause me to die? And Saul sware to her by the Lord, saying, As the Lord liveth, there shall no punishment happen to thee for this thing. Then said the woman, Whom shall I bring up unto thee? And he said, Bring me up Samuel. And when the woman saw Samuel, she cried with a loud voice, and the woman spake to Saul, saying, Why hast thou deceived me? For thou art Saul. And the king said unto her, Be not afraid, for what sawest thou? And the woman said unto Saul, I saw gods ascending out of the earth. And he said unto her, What form is he of? And she said, An old man cometh up, and he is covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel. And he stooped with his face to the ground and bowed himself. And Samuel said to Saul, Why hast thou disquieted me to bring me up? And Saul answered, I am sore distressed, for the Philistines make war against me. And God has departed from me, and answereth me no more, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called thee, that thou mayest make known unto me what I shall do. Then said Samuel, Wherefore then dost thou ask of me, seeing the Lord has departed from thee, and is become thine enemy? And the Lord hath done to him as he hath spake by me, for the Lord hath rent the kingdom out of thine hand, and given it to thy neighbor, even to David. Because thou obeyest not the voice of the Lord, nor executest his fierce wrath upon Amalek, therefore hath the Lord done this thing unto thee this day. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with thee into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow shalt thou and thy sons be with me. The Lord also shall deliver the host of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. Then Saul fell straightway all along on the earth, and was sore afraid, because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no bread all the day, nor all the night. And the woman came unto Saul and saw that he was sore troubled, and said unto him, Behold, thine handmaid hath obeyed thy voice, and I have put my life in thine hand, and have hearkened unto thy words which thou spakest unto me. Now therefore, I pray thee, hearken thou also unto the voice of thy handmaid, and let me set a morsel of bread before thee and eat, that thou mayest have strength when thou goest on thy way. But he refused and said, I will not eat. But his servants, together with the woman, compelled him, and he hearkened unto their voice. So he arose from the earth and sat upon the bed. And the woman had a fat calf in the house, and she hasted and killed it, and took flour and kneaded it, and did bake unleavened bread thereof. And she brought it before Saul and before his servants, and they did eat. Then they rose up and went away that night. So, the Witch of Endor. Gotta love this.
She says in there, let you and your sons will be with me by the next day. And Samuel, we know, was a man of God. So will Saul be in heaven?
Well,
that doesn't mean that we can't believe that God is God, and that just because we don't do right. Because a lot of us don't do right.
A lot of us do not do right. And based solely off of the testimony of the book of 1 Samuel here, I personally have a really hard time expecting to find Saul in heaven. I just really do have a hard time.
Except for that particular section where it says, you will be with me.
There's a couple of different thoughts to that, and we're actually kind of jumping ahead on what I was alluding to earlier. Number one, there's the idea of, okay, Saul and his boys are going to go to paradise, where Samuel and the others are, or it's in reference to being in the spirit realm. Which, when you are dead, you're now in the spirit realm. So, yeah, I personally feel that that's simply an allusion to you're going to be in the spirit realm yourself.
It's not up to us anyway.
Exactly. God is the ultimate judge.
Don't worry about it. It just ran across my mind, does it? Because we know that Jonathan was a believer.
Yeah.
And we know for sure that he's going to heaven.
Yeah, he's one of those people that we find in the Bible where there's a decent amount of material on, where there's no evil report of him. Now, we know he was a sinner like all the rest of us,
right.
But at the same time, it's not like you can sit there and say, oh, look, he did that, or look, he did that. I mean, we got three or four instances of David sinning, but we got nothing on Jonathan. So, yeah, I would say Jonathan definitely in heaven. Couldn't say one way or t'other about his brothers. Saul, like I said, I just got a really hard time picturing that. So, all that being said, what we've got here is a very misguided confidence going on in this particular chapter. It starts off with the Philistines are getting their armies together. And Achish, he's got all the confidence in the world that David is completely sold out to him. David is going to be his right-hand man. David is going to go in there and he's going to kill so many Israelites. He's going to make Achish so proud. David is extremely confident that somehow he's going to be able to pull this off without getting busted. One way or the other, he outright tells Achish, hey, you're going to see exactly what I can do. Achish is taking that of like, yeah, he's going to kill Israelites. And David's just sitting there like, I'm coming for you. But then you get Saul. And he is supremely confident that in spite of his life that he has been living at least since he became king, that God's still going to say, because he's king and I'm the one who made him king, I'm still going to take care of him. And then when God is silent, Saul is petrified to the point where he becomes supremely confident if he can just talk to somebody who might be in the know, things could possibly work out. And that leads him to becoming supremely confident if he can get someone who deals with familiar spirits to call up Samuel. Samuel will tell him what he needs to know, because he always liked Samuel, and Samuel always liked him. And we put confidence in too many wrong things. But that's how things go. These events take place here in chapter 28, with the possible exception of the first couple of verses. All this takes place in a single night. I think it'd be really easy to, despite the fact that Saul has killed all the witches and wizards that he could and run out all the rest, that, you know, there's always that one person who's keeping an ace up their sleeve, who's keeping someone's business card in their back pocket just in case. And so Saul is expecting one of his men to have done something like this. So he's able to say, hey, find me a woman who deals with familiar spirits. Okay, wink, wink. And I, because, you know, I know I ran them all out, but wink, wink. I know one of you all knows somebody. And they come back really quick. You just kind of picture them turning their back saying, should we tell them? Yeah, maybe we should tell them. I think it's time to do it. Okay, yeah, let's go and do it. And they just turn back around. Here you go, boss. We got a card for you. It all just takes place there in the one night, and it just goes bad. So, verse number one. And it came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for warfare to fight with Israel. And Achish said unto David, know thou assuredly that thou shalt go out with me to battle, thou and thy men. The first couple of verses here, you know, while it may not have been taking place at the exact same time that Saul's doing all this stuff here, it's easy to spot these first two verses as being a good transition from chapter 27 into chapter 28. He just got done with David setting everything up with Achish and lying to Achish. And here's Achish. He's bought into that lie, hook, line, and sinker. Now, as far as the Philistines go, there are three key reasons why they felt that now was the time they can go in there and attack the Israelites and win. Okay? Because we all want to win. Number one, Samuel had been dead for 2 years now. There ain't no way that joker's coming back to thwart them this time. This ain't going to be chapter number 6 and 7 all over again. This is going to be, they're going to win. Number two, Saul was too busy fracturing his own people. They had the proof right there in their own camp. David and his 600 men are with the Philistines. And if that guy who's so loyal to Israel now hates Israel so much he's killing Israelites, then obviously there's other people in the land of Israel who hate Saul, and they're not going to fight for him. They will have lost their draft notice. They will not have picked up their phone when the call comes in. Hey, you're needed on the front line. People are going to be ignoring the carrier pigeons and smoke signals and all this other stuff there. So Saul's political leadership stinks, and the Philistines know it. Three, David, like we already said, David's with them. He's living with them right now. So because David's with them, Abner may have been a great general, but they know David had slain his 10,000s. They know David was a very competent general, a very competent leader, someone who, when everything's falling apart, the Israelites could rally around David and David would turn the tide because God was with him. David's on their side of the battle lines right now. But he's not there fighting them. He's preparing to go to war with them. Leastwise, that's what they think. So right now, this looks tailor-made for the Philistines to conquer. There was never any lasting peace. Just a ceasefire. So, you know, they would have their little border skirmishes. It seems to have been a while since they last had one. It's just one of those ceasefires like North Korea and South Korea have had for the last 50, 60 years. They're technically still at war over there. Well, the Israelites and the Philistines were always still at war with one another. By the way, just letting you know in case you didn't know this, they're still at war right now, okay? They just don't call them the Philistines anymore, but they're called Palestinians. Same thing. As far as Achish was aware of, David was one of his greatest allies. His hatred toward his own people led him to always make sure there were no survivors, so he could tell David was not going to turn back to the Israelites. He just knew it. He's confident above all else. David is working for the Philistines now. For Achish, this may have even been the final test of David. He could witness David's ferocity in battle for himself and say, yep, that's right. I definitely will make him my right-hand man. He's going to go beyond being an honorary Philistine. We're just going to go ahead and fully adopt him and make him a Philistine after this battle. We just know it for sure. Shame when our lives are that good that we really are able to sell everybody on that lie we just told. Verse 2, and David said to Achish, surely thou shalt know what thy servant can do. And Achish said to David, therefore will I make thee keeper of mine head forever. So David showed with this answer that he had learned a thing or two about politics. His reply was very ambiguous. Did he mean Achish would be pleased with David's performance? Or was David warning him, I'm about to kill you? Hard to tell. And truth be told, we don't honestly know. And the reason we don't honestly know is because the rest of the Philistines refused to let David go into battle with them. Sent David back to Ziklag. David gets to Ziklag, finds the Amalekites have destroyed Ziklag, took everybody hostage. And now all of a sudden he's losing all this time going down there while the battle's taking place up here. So we speculate because we know David. David's a good guy. David would have turned and fought for the Israelites against the Philistines. That's logical. It's not Bible, though. We don't have that in here. But we do believe that that's the case because David was a man after God's own heart. His testimony, he loved Israel. We know the backstory that Achish didn't know. We just can't sit here and be dogmatic about it like we are so often on so many things that we ain't got Bible for. At the moment, the best David could hope for was a miracle from God to get him out of the situation that he'd put himself into. But God is not obligated to do anything. Fortunately, he does do it. If David lived up to his expectations, he would honor David by making him the captain of his bodyguards, which was a highly coveted and trusted position. Like Nehemiah over there in the book of Nehemiah being the cupbearer to the king. I mean, you had the king's ear. You need to talk to the king, you got to talk to the king. You're head of the bodyguards, you got to have word with the king. You know, it wasn't just, sire, this is what we got to do to keep you safe at this particular place you're going to. It would be, hey, sire, you know, how about this for that? And, you know, we do some wheeling and dealing. We play cards. We do all this other good stuff here. Highly trusted position that he's offering David here. But David obviously ain't going to take it. Now, verse 3. Now, Samuel was dead. And of course, we covered Samuel there a couple of weeks back. And all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, even in his own city. And Saul had put away those that had familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. So what we've got here, beginning in verse number 3, down to the end of the chapter, is what is called a parenthetical break. This is something that is taking place aside from the main action. We just generically call this part here the Witch of Endor. Saul going to talk to the witch, well, however you want to phrase it here. What we've got here is a quick reminder going on what's taking place in Israel since so much time has been devoted to following the events of David's life. Now we need to see some of these results. Some of these roosters are coming home to roost, okay? We are reminded that Samuel was dead. And then we're told that how Saul had slain everyone who he could find who that dealt in the dark arts. Perhaps he had turned his attention this way once David had fled to the Philistines. Sort of half-hearted effort to show God just how righteous he was. Since we are not told when this took place, it could also be something he had done early on in his career, back when he was supposedly following God. Before Samuel came the first time and says, God's taken the throne away from you. It could be something that took place after the first time. And it's like, if I do some good, I kiss up to God, God will let me keep the throne. And then, of course, chapter 15 comes along where Saul doesn't kill Agag and Samuel has to do it. But at any rate, somewhere along the line, Saul was trying to show zeal. Zeal's a great thing to have. Don't misunderstand me. But zeal has to be done correctly. Let me liken it to you like this. You take a car. You've got two sources of power in your car. You've got the gasoline in the gas tank, and you've got the electricity in the battery. Okay? Without either or, that car's not going nowhere. You need the electricity to start the engine, fire those spark plugs, and you need the gas to give those spark plugs something to start on. Otherwise, you just sit there cranking until you drain the battery too. The Holy Spirit is essentially the gasoline for our spiritual cars. We've got to have His power to get anything done. If we want to actually use His power in our lives, if we actually want to be the Christians that we are supposed to be, we need to have some zeal for God. Faith is turning the ignition key, okay? But the zeal in that battery, we've got to have that zeal. If we don't have the zeal in conjunction with the Holy Spirit, what's going to happen? Battery's dead. Okay? I got a friend many years ago. He used to drive here from Hammond, way up there, almost to the Wisconsin border, to go to work. And I will never understand why he wouldn't stop, because his car got lousy gas mileage, why he wouldn't stop and get just a gallon of fuel up there. Because he kept running out when he'd get over here. I literally had one time, he broke down on the expressway because he ran out of fuel. And so he called me, and I was like, okay, I'm just now getting off the route. I'll swing over there. Because he said he needed a jump. He didn't tell me he'd ran out of gas, that he just needed a jump. Okay. Well, I get over there, and now all of a sudden it's like, yeah, I ran out of gas. The NDOT guy came driving by, and he gave me a gallon of gas. The battery's dead now. Why is the battery dead now? Well, because I kept cranking it, just please start, please start, please start. I'm like, you had no fuel. You wasted your battery. Yeah, you're not going to start. And by the way, his battery is on this side of the car. My battery is on this side of my truck. Okay, no problem, except I'm on the Borman Expressway at 8:30 in the morning on a Saturday. There's no way in the world I'm going to get that big truck of mine turned around to where they're facing each other. Like, dude, I'm sorry. I'll give you a ride home, and you're going to have to find somebody else to give you a ride back here because I got to get over to the nursing home. But still, he wasted his zeal. Saul wasted his zeal because he did not have the empowering from God in his life at this point in time. Because he was too busy trying to do things Saul's way, and then he would do this over here in the name of God. Okay. Good for you, Saul. You got rid of all the dark arts dealers. Whoop-dee-doo. That's not going to buy you into heaven. That's not going to buy you one more day here on earth. Anyways, the people had every reason to mourn the loss of Samuel as long as they had, which we kind of get the impression that they might even still be lamenting his death at this time, since it's being brought up that, and now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had lamented him. It just kind of gives the impression it was more than the average amount of time there, because they realized, while they may have gotten mad at Samuel because his boys were sons of Belial, they were no good, they weren't like their daddy at all, so hey, give us a king. Did people truly regretted demanding a king, because they realized they'd done messed up bad by having Saul as their king. So yeah, they're mourning, but it's too little too late for them as well. His loss basically meant that Saul could fully lose his grip at any time and lead them to their destruction, which he's about to do. Again, we don't know where Gad, the prophet Gad, where he was at this time. Remember, we talked about him a few months back. He came and visited David down there in Moab, says, get out of here, get back up into the land of Judah. And then Gad walked off the scene again, and he's not going to be seen again until later on in 2 Samuel. So, did Saul try contacting Gad? Who knows? Did he go to the prophet school that Samuel was running? Who knows? He says that he tried talking to prophets. Were they God's prophets or his prophets? maybe that word prophet is misspelled. Maybe it's P-R-O-F-I-T, you know. Who knows? But the fact of the matter is, things just weren't going very well here for him. Verse 4. And the Philistines gathered themselves together and came and pitched in Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they pitched in Gilboa. So the battle's taking place in the northern third of the land, in the part that fell to Issachar. We see this over in Joshua chapter 19, verses 17 and 18. The Philistines were sticking to the plains, while the Israelite army encamped on a mountain to try and take advantage of the Philistines' chariots. You know, the Philistines had nice big chariots there, and they needed the flat lands of the plains to be able to run them. The Israelites, they're sticking up on a mountain because they know they're not going to run those chariots up the side of the mountain, let alone the fact that, you know, the road kind of goes this way and kind of goes that way. They know that they're safe up there. At least the Philistines don't have the advantage of the chariots up there. The Philistines were amassing their armies, and the word had reached Saul all about where and how big the army was becoming. Remember, as you read here, and the Philistines gathered themselves together, it's not a complete done deal. They've still got troops marching in here. This was not going to be another border skirmish. This was conquest. Now, Gilboa, where Saul's at, that's about 10 miles away from Endor, which, of course, is where he's going to be traveling to by night here. Verse 5. And when Saul saw the host of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart greatly trembled. Ooh. Saul saw three things from his perch. The superiority of the enemy army. He sees he's outnumbered. He's outclassed. Because he sees the sad state of his own army. Remember, you think back there to like chapter number 14, where Saul was waiting on a miracle to happen. He was waiting on anything to take place. He'd had so many of his men desert. Not the food desert, but the deserting where they go and they hide in the caves. They're climbing up trees to hide, you know, running to the hills, all this stuff there. And it got to the point where Jonathan and his armor bearer, they went to the group of Philistines. Oh, look, the Israelites, they're climbing out of their holes. The men were terrified. It's kind of the same thing here. Saul might have his 3,000 chosen men, but the rest of the men, they remember pre-David versus Goliath. They remember Goliath coming out there challenging for 40 days and 40 nights. Come on out and fight me. And they're still terrified because they know David's not coming this time. So Saul realizes, man, my army's in bad shape. And the separation he had with God, he realizes that as well. As he's sitting there, man, I'm trying to talk to prophets. They can't give me nothing. I'm dreaming dreams. The dreams don't mean nothing. I got me a made in China Urim here, and that ain't telling me nothing. What do I do? I mean, he realizes God just ain't talking to him. And when God ain't talking to you and you're trying desperately to do something, anything, scary thought.
Another thought to add in there. It says that he was trying to get a hold of God. Verse number 6. And when Saul inquired of the Lord answered him not, neither by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by prophets. The question is, how many times did Saul actually try?
Exactly.
Because the reason being is a lot of times in our life, we will, Lord, please help me. And then that's, we tried, and God didn't answer. But wait a minute. Did you keep going, and did you give God the opportunity? Because if we truly give God the opportunity, he never lets us down, regardless if it's a no, regardless if it's a yes, because he has never let anyone down before. But we, a lot of times, God. And it's just an interesting thought to think about is, how many times did he actually try to get a hold of him? Was it a one quick time? Or two quick times? Because God never says it's going to be immediate.
Yep. Matthew chapter 7, verse 7. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, it shall be opened unto you. Three statements in that one verse there, and all three statements are what's called a present imperative. Present imperative is just a fancy way of saying this is a continuous command. We are to keep asking, we are to keep seeking, we are to keep knocking until we finally get the answer. Heard Darren Rogers preach on similar to what Brother Tim was just talking about there years ago, and he likened it to a phone call. We pick up the phone, we dial it, and there's God's number, and just as God picks up, we hang up. Hey, God, how you doing? And we hung up. Don't even give God a chance to sit here, and he's like, hello? Hello? I mean, it didn't even connect. I thought I heard you say, how are you? But, hello? Who's there? You know, that's how we end up treating God. And quite possibly how Saul ended up doing. Because too often times we treat God like a break glass in case of emergency. Break it. All right, now we're able to do something about it. That works for the fire extinguisher you're going for, the fire alarm you're going for. Problem is, even if you grab that fire extinguisher, you didn't prevent the fire to begin with. Saul could have prevented the fire to begin with had he only been obedient to God from the word go. But he didn't. Now, I'm not saying that it would have prevented the Philistines from ever attacking. In all honesty, you sit there and you start looking at Samuel, the first 20 years that he ministered as the judge of Israel. It actually lines up with the 20 years of Samson. In his time frame there, Samson kept the Philistines off balance, dealing with him and all of his antics, and gave Samuel 20 years to lead a national revival to get Israel going in the right direction again. So yeah, they were still going to have problems with the Philistines. The fact of the matter is, Saul could have had a much easier time. He was the first king. Had he just obeyed, God would have established his kingdom. But Samuel told him, because you did not obey, your kingdom will not be established. In fact, it's going to be taken away from you. So, one last thing here in verse 5, and we'll call it quits for the night. As Saul recognized in an instant how much he really needed either Samuel or David or both at this time. And he could have neither. So let's make sure we don't put ourselves in that position where we're wishing we had either or both, and it's too late for either one. All right, any questions, comments, or concerns? All right, if not,